The Man in the Hut. A single road runs through our village in Normandy, and depending on which direction you come from, either the first or the last thing you pass is a one-story house, a virtual Quonset hut, made of concrete blocks. The roof is covered with metal, and large sheets of corrugated plastic, some green and others milk-colored, have been joined together to form an awning that sags above the front door. It's so ugly that the no trespassing sign reads as an insult. As if, people say. I mean, really. The hut was built by a man I'll call Jackie, who used to live there with his wife and his wife's adult daughter, Clotilde, who was retarded. On summer evenings after their dinner, the wife would dress her daughter in pajamas and a bathrobe and walk her either through the village or in the opposite direction, where the road steepens and winds in a series of blind curves. Depending upon the weather, Clotilde wore plaid bedroom slippers or a pair of rubber boots that came to above her knees and changed her walk to a kind of goose step. I'd heard from neighbors that she attended a special school, but I think it was more of a sheltered workshop, the type at which the students perform simple tasks, putting bolts into bags, say. Though I never heard her speak, she did make noises. It's a contradiction in terms, but if forced to describe what came out of her mouth, I'd call it an upbeat moan, not unpleasant, but joyful. I can't say that Clotilde was a friend, but it made me happy to know that she was around. The same was true of her mother and her stepfather, the whole family. Jackie had some sort of problem with his leg and usually walked no farther than he had to. He drove a truck so small and quiet it seemed like a toy. And every so often, as I was walking into town, he'd pull over and offer me a ride. On one of these trips, he attempted to explain that he had a metal plate in his head. My French comprehension wasn't very good at the time, and his pointing back and forth between his temple and the door of the glove compartment only confused me. "You invented glove compartments. Your glove compartment has ideas of its own. I'm sorry, I don't understand. I later learned that when he was a boy, Jackie had found an unexploded grenade in one of the nearby fields. He pulled the pin and threw it, but not quite far enough. Thus the metal plate and his messed up leg. His hearing had been affected as well, and his eyes were deeply shadowed and encircled by spidery scars. Crew cut, dented brow, lower jaw jutting just slightly forward. Had he been tall, his appearance might have startled you. But as it was, he was pint-sized, 5'2", maybe 5'4" tops. When the villagers spoke of Jackie, they used the words slow and gentle. So it seemed outrageous when the police stormed the ugly cinder block hut and took him off to jail. Someone or other spoke to the local counselor, and within an hour, everyone knew that Jackie was suspected of sexually molesting his wife's grandchildren, who were aged 6 and 8, and occasionally visited from their home an hour or so away. It was speculated that he also molested Clotilde, but I couldn't bring myself to believe it. Hugh says I just don't want to believe it, and I tell him he's right. I don't. She and her mother left our village shortly after Jackie was taken away, and I never saw either of them again. With no one to maintain it, the house that was ugly became even uglier. Our neighbors across the road would often comment on what an eyesore it was, and while agreeing, I'd lament the sorry state of my French. Oh, my comprehension had improved. I could understand just about everything that was said to me. But when it came to speaking, I tended, and still do, to freeze up. It wouldn't hurt me to be more social, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. The phone rings and I avoid it. Neighbors knock and I duck into the bedroom or crouch behind the daybed until they've left. How different things might be, I think, if, like Jackie, I had no more hiding places. Though harsh in other respects, prison would be an excellent place to learn a foreign language. Total immersion, and you'd have the new slang before it even hit the streets. Unlike the French school I actually attended, this one, when it came to verbs, would likely start with the imperative. Bend over, take it, that kind of thing. Still, though, you'd have your little conversations in the cafeteria, in the recreation room or craft center, if they have them in French prisons, and I imagine they do. me, Jean-Claude, do you like the glaze I've applied to my shapely jug? Of the above, I can say, tell me, Jean-Claude, do you like the, jug? Glaze is one of those words that shouldn't be too difficult to learn. And the same goes for shapely. I'm pretty good when it comes to retaining nouns and adjectives, but the bit about applying the glaze to the shapely jug, that's where I tend to stumble. In English, it's easy enough. I put this on that. But in French, such things have a way of biting you in the ass. I might have to say, do you like the glaze the shapely jug accepted from me? Or, do you like the shapely jug and the glaze of which I applied earlier? For safety's sake, perhaps I'd be better off breaking the one sentence into three. Look at the shapely jug. Do you like the glaze? I did that. If I spent as much time speaking to my neighbors as I do practicing imaginary conversations in the prison craft center, I'd be fluent by now and could quit making excuses for myself. As it is, whenever someone asks how long I've been in France, I wonder if it's possible to literally die of shame. I'm away a lot, I always say. 2.5 months in America, and at least 2 in England, sometimes more. Yes, but how long ago did you come to France? What? I asked, how long have you been in France? Then I might say, I love chicken. Or, big bees can be dangerous. Anything to change the subject. What I needed was an acquaintance, and what I wound up with was Jackie. This was after his release, obviously. He'd been gone for close to 3 years when I walked past the hut one day and noticed a pair of little black socks hanging on the clothesline. Who do you suppose those belong to? I asked the woman across the road, and she pulled an unusually sour face and said, well, who do you think? I'd imagined that, like his wife and stepdaughter, Jackie would move away and start over, but it seemed that he had no place to go and no money to go there with. After hanging out his socks, he picked up his rake and hoe and started getting his lawn in shape. It was strange. Were an American sex offender to return home, there'd be a big to-do. Here, though, it was all very quiet. No meeting was held that I was aware of, but somehow or other it was agreed that no one would look at or speak to this man. He would be treated as if he were invisible, and with luck, the isolation would drive him away. He'd been back in his hut for a week or so when I walked by and saw him inside his front gate, worrying something with the tip of his cane. Jackie had always been kind to me, so when he looked up and said hello, I employed one of the formalities I'd learned years earlier in my French class. I am content to see you again, I said. Then I shook his hand. What did you do that for? Hugh later asked, and I said, well, what could I do? Someone says hello and sticks his hand out, and you're just supposed to what, walk away? If he's a child molester, yes, he said. But I'd like to have seen what he would have done in the same situation. A few years later, after Jackie died of cancer, and the garden he had so carefully tended had turned to weeds, I gave the baccalaureate address at a certain American university. When the speech was finished, I joined a procession of deans and distinguished fellows back to the president's house, and it was there that a well-known politician approached and extended his hand, saying, I just want you to know how much I enjoyed that. Now, this politician, it's not that I simply disagree with him. I despise him. I loathe him. My friends and I, the way we throw his name around, you'd think we were talking about the devil himself. Spittle forms in the corners of our mouths as we denounce him, his party, and the people we refer to as his henchmen and cronies. I hadn't known that this politician was going to be in the procession that day. Rather, I turned around and there he was, the two of us dressed in flowing robes, like wizards. I just want you to know how much I enjoyed that. So did I place a pox upon him? Did I spit in his face or even turn my back? Of course not. With everyone watching, I looked up and said, oh, thank you. Because he had held out his hand, I took it, just as I had taken Jackie's after his release from prison. I said to Hugh after the graduation, but I wasn't enthusiastic about it. Sure, I said, oh, and thank you, but anyone who knows me would know that I was faking it, that I didn't really mean the thank you part. Well, Hugh said, I guess you showed him. Had the politician been my neighbor, I might have moved. That's how disgusted I would have felt. But Jackie, because of the metal plate in his head, because you could put a magnet to his temple and it would stay there, aroused pity rather than anger, or at least he did in me. I didn't go out of my way to pass his hut, but neither did I go out of my way to avoid passing it. If he was in the yard, he'd say hello, and I would say hello back, or, yes, it certainly is warm, or whatever seemed called for. And in this way, a word here, a wave there, little by little, the summer advanced, and Jackie came to see the two of us as friends. One afternoon, he invited me inside his front gate to show me the tomatoes he'd planted. Well, and I looked to see if any of our neighbors were watching. No one was, so I opened the latch, saying, okay, sure. During the years that he had been away, Jackie's hair had gone from brown to gray. His eyes were flat and more heavily shadowed, and what had once been a pronounced limp had grown more subtle. It seemed that while in prison, he had had a hip replaced, and the way he walked now was miles better than it had been before the operation. Hey, he said, and he gestured behind him in the direction of his open front door. Do you want to come in and look at my x-rays? As I later said to Hugh, do you tell a person, no, I don't want to see pictures of your insides? Of course not. How can you? The hut was a lot cozier than I'd imagined it. In the kitchen were the same sorts of things you'd find in the homes of any of our neighbors. A postal calendar picturing a kitten. A hanging copper saucepan turned into a clock. Souvenir salt and pepper shakers in the shapes of castles and peasants and wooden shoes. The room was tight and clean and smelled of watermelon-scented dish detergent. From the kitchen I could see the bedroom and rows of medications neatly arranged upon the dresser. Little radio. Little TV, little easy chair. It was like a troll's house. Jackie's x-rays were as large as bath mats, and he washed and dried his hands before removing them from their separate envelopes and presenting them to me. When handed a photograph of someone's wife or children, I knew how to form the appropriate compliment. How pretty, I can say, or how like you. What nice eyes. What a pleasant smile. Hip replacement presented more of a challenge, and I alternated between, I like the pin, and simply, ouch. On or about the fifth x-ray, I looked through a clear patch of plastic, past the front yard, and into the hills on the opposite side of the road, where another of our neighbors grazes his sheep. The flock had been shorn earlier that day, and those in view seemed oddly aware of how dumpy and vulnerable they looked. I have to go, I said. And in the way of good neighbors the world over, Jackie said, stay, why don't you? I was just going to make some coffee. Several weeks after that, he invited me in to look at his government-issued ID card. Oh, I don't want to put you out. Not at all, he said. And 2 minutes later, I found myself back at his kitchen table. The ID was in a bright plastic folder, the sort of thing that a young girl might carry. On the cover was a cartoon pony, having his mane braided by a troop of friendly ladybugs. I think I said, all right, then. Jackie opened the folder and withdrew his identity card, a small color photograph attached by grommets to a stiff piece of paper. As when looking at the x-rays, I didn't quite know what to say. His birth date, his height, the color of his eyes. He was obviously proud of something, but I couldn't tell what it was. See, he said, right here, look. He pointed to the corner, and I saw that the government had classified him as a grand, mutilated person. The grand business was new to me, but the other part was familiar from riding the Paris buses. These seats are reserved for the elderly and for those who have been mutilated in the war, the signs used to read. It's a much stronger word than wounded or handicapped, and I imagine that if we used it in the United States, enlistment in the volunteer army would fall by at least half. As a grand mutilated person, Jackie was entitled to a discount on all train travel. With the metal plate, I got 50% off, but now with the hip replacement, it's gone up to 75%, he told me, both for me and the person I'm traveling with, 75% off. I handed him back his ID card. Those are some real savings. You know, he said, we should maybe take a trip together, over to Brittany, down to Marseille, wherever we wanted. It took a moment for his "we" to register, and another moment to come up with a fitting response. That would be something, I finally said, thinking later that at least I didn't lie. Where's David? The neighbors might ask. And Hugh could say, oh, he and Jackie are off on vacation. You know how those two are. Give them 75% off on their tickets and the sky's the limit. It was only after I left the house that I started feeling insulted. What made Jackie think that I'd want to travel with him? Could he possibly have believed I'd be swayed by the discount? Or did he think, the way certain people might, that the two of us belonged together? The homosexual and the child molester being cousins of sorts, like ostriches and emus. I'm usually not paranoid about this kind of thing, but in a small village, you sometimes have to wonder. Why had the neighbors to our immediate left, a truck driver and his family, never said anything more than hello to us? This after years of living next door. Then there was a man two houses down who stopped me one afternoon and asked where I slept. I've been in that place of yours and there's only one bedroom, he said. This is the same man who chained a goat to a tree in his backyard and let it starve to death, so in his case, it was probably the craziness talking. Just as with Jackie, it was the loneliness. I usually passed his hut every other day, but after the incident with his ID card, I cut it back to twice a week, and then to once a week. Late that August, I traveled to Scotland, and on my return, an irritated Hugh collected me at the train station. What's eating you? I asked, and he gunned the engine, saying, ask your little friend. What happened was that Jackie had come looking for me. He'd knocked on our door while I was out of town, and asked in his loud country voice if David could come out and play. Those weren't his exact words, but according to Hugh, they might as well have been. Not everyone saw the child molester calling my name on our front stoop, but the ones who did see were pretty well connected, and it took no time at all for the story to spread. From that day on, I always wore headphones when walking past Jackie's hut. He may have called out to me, but I neither heard him nor raised my head to look in his direction. And it went on this way for 3 years, till I sort of forgot about him. We didn't speak again until after he'd gotten his diagnosis. The cancer, I'd heard, was in his esophagus, and its progress was swift and merciless. In a matter of months, he was carved down to nothing, face all gaunt, pants held up with a short length of rope. I saw him on his front stoop a week before he died, and when I waved, he beckoned me inside the gate, and we shook hands one last time. I found myself wondering if the cancer had upped his train discount, bumped it from 75% to something even higher, but it's a hard question to ask when you're not fluent, and I wouldn't have wanted him to take it the wrong way.